Right. So I'm going to talk about Darwinian speciation in Amazon butterflies, in particular Heliconius and Ithomene butterflies. So, of course, many people have talked about speciation before. But this is, I think, as many people have mentioned already, there's a sort of conflict between Darwin's original idea of speciation, which was all about natural selection, and a sort of more recent idea, which is that natural selection wasn't so important, and instead geographic isolation was more important. And obviously that's a very crude distinction, but I think that is the distinction that I find in the literature. If you're going to study speciation, you may as well go somewhere where there are a lot of species. And so I've spent most of my life in the rainforest, in particular in the Amazon, where it's probably the most diverse place for insects, plants, birds, and so on. And in particular, I've studied these two groups, the Heliconian butterflies and the Ithomene butterflies on the right, Heliconians on the left. There's many interesting features of the biology of these organisms that I could tell you about, which are perhaps much more important for their niche. But there's a very interesting peculiarity of these butterflies, which is that they show mimicry among the species. So here's a mimicry ring, including Ithomene butterflies and Heliconian butterflies, and also a moth, showing that they all adopt the similar pattern. And this was first recognized by Henry Walter Bates, who worked in the Amazon for a while. And he felt that this wasn't just an adaptation. The reason for mimicry between species wasn't just an adaptation. It also told you something about speciation as well. So he said the processes by which a mimetic analogy is brought about in nature is a problem which involves that of the origin of all species. So he felt he was finding the key to the origin of species in these mimetic butterflies. The work by Bates was updated by this guy, Fritz Müller. Now, Fritz Müller came up with the idea that two species of poisonous butterflies would mimic each other as a kind of mutualism. And the way this worked is that predators learning the poisonous butterfly would remember the pattern. And so if two species, individuals of two species, could share the same color pattern, they would both gain some advantage. And in fact, he did, as far as I know, the first mathematical model in evolutionary biology. I suppose you could call it mathematical ecology, because it wasn't genetic at that time, to show how the relationship would work. And in particular, he came up with a very counterintuitive result, which is that the benefits to mimicry between these two mutualistic species went as the inverse square of the relative abundances of the two species. I'm not going to go into that, but I can discuss it later. I think it's a fascinating result. The thing that really keyed Bates and also Müller into mimicry was not the fact that different species looked alike, because, of course, they could have inherited the same color pattern from a common ancestor. What it was the fact that every few hundred miles along the Amazon, Bates found the same species but with a different color pattern, and the same pairs of species copying each other with a different color pattern. So it was this recognition of the geographic pattern of mimicry that really cued him into the fact that there was something going on with natural selection. And this is true in Heliconius. Can I use this? Which is the center one. Right. So, and this is true in Heliconius irato and Heliconius melpomene. Many of you may have seen this picture before, but what's not generally realized is all these different geographic races, and they're perfectly interfertile, of Heliconius irato, all occur in a small area of Ecuador and northern Peru, roughly the size of Hungary or England. A small area with many different geographic forms arising. But in each area where the color pattern is fixed, you find an almost exact copy of other species, including Heliconius melpomene. And so this copying is perfect geographically between the species, but varies enormously within species. And in fact, this is the sort of geographic color pattern variation that you see. And I've just plotted the major color pattern groups as green, red, and blue, just to give you an idea of the overlap. And this is just in one species, but if I plotted a map of Heliconius melpomene, it would be very similar. Now, mimicry is important in speciation for the following reason. We do get hybrid zones between color pattern races of each species of Heliconius. So this is Heliconius irato, two different geographic races. If you go to the center of the contact zone between the two races, we find multiple phenotypes, which essentially can be arranged along a hybrid index. And you can see that there's a single peak, a single mode in the distribution of the color patterns. So most of these individuals in the center of the zone are hybrids, if you want to call them that. But there are other zones between slightly more divergent forms where the hybrids are much rarer. And this is the case in another hybrid zone we studied, Heliconius irato and Heliconius himera. They're parapatric forms, but in this case, they differ in that there's very few hybrids shown in the middle. Now, this creates essentially two separate adaptive peaks because the predators are learning the pure species. That's the main thing they see. And the hybrids you would expect would be selected against. So this is a kind of reproductive isolation, if you like, generated by the ecology because the hybrids are rarer and therefore not disfavored. So what I'm going to talk about today, I'm not going to talk about all the work that we've done, but I'm going to talk about a few key factors. I'm going to talk about selection on mimicry in hybrid zones, just to show you that we have evidence that it is strongly selected. I'm going to talk about the new genomics and genetics that's coming out of this system. Then I'm going to backtrack and give you a little bit of evidence against a simple non-Darwinian speciation argument against vicariance, that is, against the idea that allopatry was particularly important in this group. And finally, I'm going to discuss hybridization between species and hybrid speciation. So first of all, let's look at mimicry in hybrid zones. If you cross these different geographic races of Heliconius irato together, you get a limited number of phenotypes, and the same with Heliconius melpomene, limited number of phenotypes, which we can Mendelize. So essentially, it turns out that there's three or four genes in each species which explain the color pattern differences. And you can then go through the hybrid zone and plot gene by gene the gene frequency climb, the changes in gene frequency along distance, through a hybrid zone, and this is Heliconius irato and Heliconius melpomene, and you can see that all the genes correlate, as you might expect. And of course, what we expect to be happening here is that there's very strong selection in this region for this color pattern. The predators will recognize this color pattern. If one of these guys wanders over the hybrid zone, it will be not recognized as unpalatable and will be attacked by this frequency-dependent selection that Müller originally suggested. And so we expect selection against that. And similarly, if this one of these RAID individuals flies over the hybrid zone, the other side, it will also be selected against. So we get this flip-flop frequency-dependent selection, which should maintain the hybrid zone. Now, when I first started this, I had no idea how strong the selection might be. It might have been 1%, in which case I would have completely failed to have a career in biology, but as it turned out, it was a little bit stronger than that. So we did a number of experiments where we actually moved butterflies over the hybrid zone and compared that with butterflies moved from within the color pattern race and did a mark recapture study and showed that the survival of foreign individuals was about 50% of the survival of the local color patterns. And the indirect estimates, we can use the Klein theory that was then being developed, especially by Nick Barton, and we were able to estimate selection based on that. And again, the selection was a similar sort of order of magnitude. In fact, the selection per gene locus, very wide confidence intervals, was about 10%. The selection per locus measured by an indirect selection estimate was 20%, which is pretty good for ecology, I reckon. Pretty accurate. Well, recently, we've been going further and finding out a little bit more about the genes. And this has really led to the whole genomics program in Heliconius, which is now flowering right across the America and into France and Britain. And there's a lot of people now involved with sequencing the genome, which we've now got a draft sequence of Heliconius melpomene. Now, it turns out that the original thing we found was I had a student called Margarita Beltran who did some AFLP analysis, and she found a linked marker to one of the color pattern loci. This was the A41 locus. And we then sequenced around these regions and found genes that were identifiable based on Drosophila and Bombyx data. And then we sequenced the same regions in different species, and we found, really to our surprise, that the yellow color pattern gene in melpomene and in erato, which switches yellow to non-yellow, turns out to be linked to the same region of the same chromosome in both erato and melpomene. They're mimetic species, but they really don't hybridize. They're completely unrelated groups within Heliconius. So we think that these have evolved independently in the different lineages. And of course, they're very divergent regions. But even more surprisingly, we found another species that switches its color pattern between different mimicry rings of Ithomian butterflies. This is a Heliconius, but it mimics a completely different family of butterflies. This also has what we call a supergene in the same region, and it's also very tightly linked to the same region of the same chromosome. So we found this rather strange pattern that this is kind of super regulatory region in the chromosome, which seems to be changing all these color patterns in Heliconius. And there are a number of these. We know of at least three major regions. And so this was our 2006 estimate. You can see our map is very, very weak and everything. But by today, we now have back libraries. These are bacterial artificial chromosomes that span the regions of two of these color patterns. The red switching color pattern, the BD region, and we have all the genes mapped, and the same with the yellow region that I've already mentioned. So we've now sequenced through all of those, all the backs have been sequenced, and indeed we've sequenced the whole genome. So this has led to this whole genomics program. And we can then go back to the genome and resequence across the same hybrid zone between different races of Heliconius melpomene in this case, and look at divergence across the hybrid zone in terms of FST. So look at this red gene region, the BD region, between these two geographic races of Heliconius melpomene. And the red represents the average pairwise divergence, FST, between two individuals across the hybrid zone. The blue represents the average pairwise divergence between a pair of individuals within the same color pattern race. And those dark blue and dark red are the averages of all of the pairwise comparisons. And the black represents the FST for all the individuals. We actually had four individuals sequenced of each kind. So across the BD region, you can see where there's a white gap between the two, between the blue and the red lines, we have really good evidence for strong divergence that is something to do with the color pattern. So this is kind of an island of divergence in the genome within a species that determines the difference between the two color pattern races. And when we look at other sequenced back clones with no color pattern effect, you can see that the reds and the blacks overlap each other completely. In other words, there's no specific divergence across this region at all. In fact, the FST is around 0.002 if you have a good sample size right across the whole genome. So there's hardly any differentiation. So that's a bit about the genomics that we've got to. I'm now just going to tell you a little bit about some of the things we did with geography. So one of the things we've been studying is suture zones between geographic races of butterflies and indeed between sort of semi-species of butterflies across the Amazon basin. In the past, there was a theory that the Pleistocene refuges explain much of the diversity of these color patterns. And it's a nice story. It fits kind of nicely. But if that were true, we would expect the ages of the color pattern races and the semi-species to be about the same. Well, we find suture zones. We find areas where multiple species have hybrid zones, which suggests that there's some feature about that geographic environment. And some of these forms are very recent, so the Pleistocene is very recent. Some of these forms are as little as a few thousand years old, maybe. Some of them are many millions of years old. But what we did find is that the ages of the species and subspecies was not concordant with each other. So we find some very old pairs and some very young pairs all meeting in the same place. And so this isn't a very strong, very likely prediction of a classical vicariance hypothesis for divergence. And here's two rather extreme examples. This is Melania, which is an Ithomian butterfly. You're going to have to remember a lot of these names. I'm going to test you on them afterwards. This Melania, there are a number of species of Melania. They're copied by Heliconius pneumata. Heliconius pneumata is a polymorphic form that has that gene that was sequenced and is a supergene, just published in Nature 2 weeks ago, I think, the fact that an inversion explains the supergene mimicry of this system by Mathieu Giron. But the Melania here that I'm looking at, this is the genealogy, mitochondrial genealogy of Melania. Essentially, we cannot, by any molecular marker, tell the species of Melania apart. And yet they're good species. We find a few hybrids, but very few hybrids. Essentially, we're talking about good species here, which are so recent that we can't really distinguish them at any molecular marker. The only way we can distinguish them is by running a whole bunch of markers, and then we find frequency differences using structure or something like that, such as Andrew Hendry has already talked about. If you there's about five species in my area, and we think there's about 10 species in this whole group that are very, very similar. There's some other species of Melania that are more distant, as you might expect. If we look at another group of species, this is in the genus Olearia, completely unrelated mimicry ring, but they also have mimicry. Here we have enormous divergence between the geographic races that are coming together. So the geographic races of Olearia are older than the full species, which also have geographic races of the Melania. So what this suggests is that some species are evolving extremely rapidly, switching over mimicry rings and speciating. And other species, like the Olearia, are very, very sluggish in their evolution. They're evolving maybe a tenth or less the rate of the Melaneas. So There's something going on here which is nothing to do with some external forcing agency such as allopatry or vicarians. And I suggest this something is probably natural selection and something to do with mimicry, host plants, and other ecological factors. Another thing we can do is look at the distribution of sibling species or sister species. And I've got a student, Neil Russer, working on this right now, and he has plotted out the distributions of a lot of these species. So we do find some classic allopatric species pairs like Heliconius ismenius and Heliconius pneumata. Pneumata is an Amazonian species. Ismenius is largely Central American and west of the Andes. But we find a lot of species also in which the sister species, some very closely related, are found together. They're found sympatrically. And in fact, if you plot out the pattern of the numbers of sister species and their proportion overlap in their distribution range, there's a very high proportion that are overlapping almost 100%. In contrast, if you look at birds, which of course led to the allopatric theory with Ernst Mayr in particular, birds typically have most of their sister species allopatric. So something's going on in these butterflies which is unusual and maybe different to the birds. And this suggests, I think, processes other than pure allopatry being involved. And the last thing I'm going to talk about is hybridization and hybrid speciation. Increasingly, in collections, as we went around the world, we were able to find very rare specimens showing evidence of hybridization between the species. And because they're pretty butterflies, and because butterfly collectors like strange specimens, these collections are preserved. So you can go around the museums and actually find these specimens. They're often named as separate species, which they're not. And you realize that they're hybrids between two rather more common species. And so we were able to document these. And I've rarely found them in the wild. In fact, I've never found them in the wild. But I did have a student who found a wild hybrid between these two species. And we sequenced the legs of this species and were able to check who the parents were and who was the mummy and who was the daddy. And the mummy was a Heliconius melpomene and the daddy was a Heliconius ithila. And in fact, he got so excited after catching this specimen that he rubbed it. He wasn't a professional entomologist, you know, otherwise he would have preserved it very carefully. But he kept on opening it up and showing people. So it's a very rubbed specimen. Hybridization is extremely rare in these species. I do want to emphasize these are good species. They're not like Darwin's finches, which are just really like ecological races. These are really good species. They even have female hybrid sterility, which concords with Haldane's rule. The males are fertile, and you can backcross them. But there are many species involved. In fact, there's about 35% of the 46 species are known to hybridize with at least one other species. And you can get non-sister species hybridizing as well as sister species. As I said, the females are often sterile. Haldane's rule. Backcrossing is possible to nearby species, and hybrid speciation is also said to occur. If you plot the numbers of hybrids found in collections, these red spots, against the this is between each pair of species against the divergence genetic divergence. This is measured just by mitochondrial DNA divergence. You find that the hybridization rate is higher in closely related species. This is sort of what you expect. You know, closely related species are more prone to hybridize. And backcrossing is also more common. That's shown by the halos. The backcrosses we know that are in collections are more common near the species boundary, near divergence equals zero, than higher divergence forms. And in fact, if you look at the phylogeny, the stars represent the hybrids. The hybrids are found in the more rapidly evolving groups, Euides, the Heliconius irato group, and the Heliconius melpomene group. And this sort of suggests an idea that I came up with, and Cheng Yi Wu, I think, most famously came up with, which is that maybe speciation isn't a kind of complete reproductive isolation, as Meyer would have us believe. It's a slow acquisition of divergence in different parts of the genome. So you start with a few islands of divergence in the genome. These represent, let's say, the geographic races. And then you slowly fill this in until more and more of the genome becomes divergent as speciation proceeds. But actually, speciation occurs maybe somewhere here in the spectrum and not here. And this is because we can backcross parts of the genome that aren't involved in reproductive isolation or ecological differentiation between the hybrids and the parent forms. And so this hybrid is actually a non-sister hybrid between two species in different parts of the Heliconius melpomene group. You can see that from the phylogeny. The commonest hybrids are between these two groups, the Heliconius sidno group and the Heliconius melpomene group. There has been suggested to be hybrid speciation in Heliconius, and this is the example by Jesus Mavares of Heliconius hirypa. I just want to rush through this. Here's the melpomene group. The red forms represent sympatric species that occur within our study site in Peru. The stars represent hybrid things that form hybrids with other species. And essentially, you can hybridize right across the whole group and backcross and change patterns and move patterns across. And there's some interesting patterns. For instance, the sort of non-phylogenetic color pattern appearances. So the ray pattern, for instance, occurs in three places in this phylogeny. What we call the postman pattern, the red forewing band pattern, occurs in two places. It also occurs down here as well. And that suggests maybe that the color patterns may have crossed over on occasion with some of this back crossing. And we've got some interesting patterns here with the Heliconius sidno group down here on the right-hand side and the Heliconius melpomene geographic races on the left-hand side. That Heliconius sidno, of course, is famously speciated, changing its color pattern to mimic a different group. But it hybridized with melpomene to produce Heliconius hirypa. But further south, there's a thing called Florencia that appears superficially almost identical to the local Heliconius melpomene race. Further south, there's a postman color pattern in Heliconius sidno. This is called Heliconius tristra. And here's another one in Peru. Heliconius timorata. So I've shown you this picture already. This is the divergence within color pattern regions, showing different regions within the color pattern regions. Now we can look at the similarity across species. So this measures the blue patterns measure the similarity between this race of Timoretta and this race of Heliconius melpomene. These are two races of melpomene, Timoretta and an Ithomian mimicking Heliconius. The pink represents the similarity between this race of Timoretta and this race of melpomene. So here the pinks are very low, but the blues are very high, suggesting a lot of sharing between these two forms of a different species. The flip side of this is this race of Heliconius timorata, which has a postman pattern, is showing a lot of pink, showing sharing between these two forms, this race of melpomene and this race of timorata. And again, you can see a few blue patches here, but these are very limited. So this similarity really measures the similarity of derived single nucleotide polymorphisms that represent probable gene transfer between these two species. And you can see that the reciprocal experiment showing the reciprocal color exchange suggests very strongly about gene sharing, probably due to hybridization between these species. And this is in exactly the same region where, within Heliconius melpomene, we get strong differentiation of the color pattern blockers. Not only that, if you look at the phylogeny in this peak region of, this is 50,000 base pairs sequenced in this region, we don't recover the species phylogeny, we recover all the RAID species coming together and all the postman species coming together. So the phylogenetic analysis suggests that these regions essentially are the same. They've evolved from a common ancestor and have been shared among species. This is completely crackers phylogeny compared with all of the rest of this region on the flanking sides, all of the rest of the genome, and it's an extremely unlikely pattern except by gene sharing. So this suggests that integration has occurred between these species. So just to sum up, I've shown you we have evidence for very strong selection on mimicry. We're now doing the genetics, and we've got the genomics done. We can show that divergence of species is ecological and at least is driven in part by mimicry, and that there's a lot of evidence now, maybe we have the best evidence of all, of hybridization and hybrid speciation in this group. And I just want to mention my collaborative group. This is Kanchan Dasmahapatra, who did especially the last hybridization and genomics work, along with Chris Jiggins' group in Cambridge. And here we are celebrating where DNA was discovered in the eagle. And this is his group, some of whom are doing the genomics, in particular Nicola Nadeau and John Davey, who's the bioinformatician who's been involved with this. Thank you very much. That's enough.
Thank you. Thank you very much. One very quick question, and we'll move on.
So, Jim, with that, are you going to try to put together reticulated phylogeny instead of that classic phylogeny?
Look, I think the phylogeny is correct.
Right.
That's the phylogeny I showed was mitochondrial DNA with nuclear genes, but we're actually doing whole genome phylogenies now. The phylogeny is correct, or at least the average phylogeny, so that if you like the backbone, so that strange phylogenetic pattern was just for that 50,000 base pairs within that peak region where we've got this color pattern gene. So that that it is not the phylogeny of the whole species.
Okay, thank you very much. Move on to Kai.